Welcome back to Troubleshooting Agile. Hi there, Jeffrey.
Hi, Squirrel.
So I hear that one of my tweets was very helpful to you with someone you were working with. So you got to tell us more about that.
Yeah, it was very funny timing. It was around the time we were recording our previous podcast. I'd had someone ask me about the phrase, the wartime leader versus peacetime leader. And it was interesting because they had the assumption that a wartime leader was someone who was very hands-on, and not just hands-on, but someone who was a micromanager, someone who was involved in all the details and making all the decisions at every level of what was going on. And they brought up Steve Jobs as an archetype. You know, he's like, isn't that what he was like? And I replied back, no, I think you misunderstand. And I think the misunderstanding is a common one, and I thought that what was made it worth discussing, this idea of what exactly a peacetime and wartime leader is. And now what's great about it is that your quote was a good example of what I was describing, which I said, the wartime leader, I said, what matters here, and there's a couple of things. One is, when we say wartime leader, we mean someone who's actually been put to the test, not just something that seems like a good idea, but that the key element about being effective is often, it's not about being a micromanager, it's about being effective. And being effective often has to do with being decisive and you know, making sure that everyone is using the time effectively. And that's where I came across your quote, which was just the picture perfect example of what I had in mind. And in your example, you were talking about a client who ran the best meeting ever. and I wonder if you could tell me more about that and what made it the best meeting ever.
Well, the thing that made it really different from all the discussions that I'd seen in this organization before is that this person was vetoing left and right and making decisions on the spot. And the company had been much nicer previously, and the culture was more inclusive. And he was being less inclusive. Now, he wasn't being impolite. He didn't say something like, Jeffrey, you're an idiot. Sit back down. You're useless. That would have been a type of unproductive conflict that would not have helped anyone. But focused on some deliveries to customers that were really near term, this person was saying, look, we're going to get it done this way. That may be suboptimal, but we're not going to explore something else. And he didn't leave any room for another discussion. He didn't leave other options open. He had listened to other options, and he was rejecting them. Now, some listeners might think, wait a minute, Jeffrey and Squirrel, have you lost your minds? Wait, aren't you the have a conversation, do joint design, people, isn't this what you wrote a whole book about? Yes, and we also talked about being decisive and having a time box in your joint design. We also talked about being tightly aligned and making sure that people were being accountable. And those are all elements of this sort of wartime CEO. I'm a pacifist, so I don't like the term very much, but I know what you mean. In this situation, you're almost forced, and it's a good thing that you're forced to be decisive after having heard the options. You're almost forced to ensure there's accountability and short timelines because the bombs are falling. The customer is calling. The bankruptcy yeah. looms, and a death sentence really does focus the mind.
The thing about your example is, though, if we go back to our book, we talked about transparency. You know, you'll tell what you're thinking, and curiosity. You really genuinely want to know what other people think. And it sounds to me like your leader here, they were definitely being transparent about what the focus was, and they were limiting the conversation, but they actually were still having the conversation. If I understand correctly, they wanted to know what people thought on the topic. He was limiting the topic of discussion, but he still wanted to hear. So if someone had surprising news that would impact their plans, he definitely wanted to hear it. Is that right?
And made room for it. And solicited it. Yes, yeah, solicited opposing views for sure. And also made a decision once those views were clear. Yep, I understand that this will be very difficult for customer service. We're going to make it more difficult for customer service for a few days while we deliver to this customer. So move the people, change the direction, delete the code, whatever it was needed deciding. That got decided. And the result was that not only did they deliver to their customer, they got the result that they wanted in the short term. Everybody got a very clear message about what the really most important items were, which in my made up example just there is not customer service. Like, okay, we got it. We're not that important. That's a painful lesson, but a painful message to hear, but it's much better than, oh yes, they're very important. Let's spend some time dealing with that and we'll tell the customer to wait. That doesn't work.
Yeah, mixed messaging was not allowed. See, I think I love your example here because as you describe it, I'm thinking it's exactly the kind of thing we talk about in our book, where we say, look, the conversational skills are about generating all the information available within the room from all the parties, and that's separate from the question of what the decision making criteria is. So whether you're doing group consensus or a vote or someone being the decider and deciding, you still want all that information available. And in fact, you almost described what I often tell people. Look, I said, if you want to be most effective, think about terms about, options and trade-offs. And everyone should be able to agree that these are the three options and these are the trade-offs between them. And then it's the decision, and it was exactly what you described. We're choosing to trade off, say, the responsiveness in client service for this benefit over here, right? So you have this explicit trade-off. Everyone agreed ahead of time that those were the trade-offs that were available, and to agree on that is separate from actually making the decision. And that whether the decision is made, by this decisive leader or the group, you still wanted the same process to get there. So it's still the same ingredients that we put in our conversations, because that's what allows effective decisions to be made. And this is the key thing. This is what allows the effective decisions to be made. And fundamentally, I think that's the, for me, that's the key of the wartime leader versus peacetime leader, is what has been tested to be effective versus things that, might sound good, but don't put up to don't stand up to the rigors of the actual trial when the time comes.
I was writing about, it's not quite a wartime situation, although it was a military unit. I was writing about this in my weekly email that I send to my community. That's at the Squirrel Squadron. If people are interested, go to squirrelsquadron.com. I write these every week. And I was writing about Lewis and Clark, the adventurers, the explorers. They went through the center of the United States when it was a wild place and nobody had been there who had a white skin. And they came at one point to this very difficult choice. They were going up a river, and the river went in two directions. They didn't know which one they should go down. And in my email, I wrote about how they actually went down both of them and got a lot of information. They had a choice between two things, and they did both, which is a really good practice. But the thing I didn't emphasize, which you're reminding me of here, is that after everybody got back, the absolute consensus in the entire unit, in the whole expeditionary force, was that the North Fork was the right one. And so they were absolutely certain, everybody else, that that was the way to go from all the evidence they had gathered. And Lewis and Clark had more experience. They knew more. And so they said, thanks for all the evidence. We've heard all the evidence. We think that evidence tells us to go south. We're going south. And thankfully, they had led well enough that the others in the group were willing to say, we think you're nuts, but we'll go south. And a few days later, they got to Great Falls on the Missouri, and that was the right place. So they knew they'd gone the right way. And it's the confidence to make those kinds of wrong decisions, possibly wrong decisions, in the face of opposition that is actually, I think, really good joint design, because you're including the information that others have shared. It's really important and interesting for you to hear, but you're not necessarily agreeing. For instance, you may have more experience as they did, and you might make a decision that's different. I've certainly overruled architectural decisions that junior developers have made after hearing carefully what their reasoning was for making another decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's the great illustration of the difference between how we gather the information and what the decision-making protocol is. These things have been studied, and it turns out like the most effective decision-making protocol varies based on the relative knowledge of the group, and that when you have the group leader is also the most experienced person with the most relevant knowledge, if they then move to consensus. In other words, if they don't own the experience that they have, the group gets worse results. And you're describing a place where they were confident in their knowledge and put it to use. But and this is the thing, though, is that, and I think for me, one of the key elements here is people have to know where they are and know the relative strengths of the different people. So the example, the person who had asked me about, they had read this Andreessen Horowitz post on peacetime CEOs versus wartime CEOs, and Steve Jobs was in there. And their takeaway was, well, Steve Jobs was a micromanager, was involved in every decision that was made. And that's not true. He had people who had more experience in some areas, and he would know where to listen to them. And he also knew what decisions he needed to own. And if you study his career after his return to Apple, this is one of the things that he would say he learned a lot in his time away from Apple, is where his expertise was and where it wasn't, and when to listen to other people. And I think that's the key element. I want to, if I can, share a funny sort of story. This might be the first time I've ever quoted Livy, the Roman writer.
Excellent. Tell us. I had to look up who he was. I did read him, but it was 30 years ago. So, and our listeners might not even know. He was a Roman historian, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And I this weekend was reading a blog post from a blog called Aku.blog, which is a collection of unmitigated pedantry. This is someone who has often written about critiquing the battle scenes in Game of Thrones, for example, saying how it was ahistorical. And that's, you can be a pedant on how fantasy or historical fiction doesn't accurately reflect how things actually happened. But putting that aside, he was describing a battle between the Roman legions and a Greek Macedonian phalanx. And he's had a whole series about why the Romans eventually, were victorious over the phalanx. But one of the key things stood out to me, which for me, it nicely captures this peacetime versus wartime element, which is, as I said, in peacetime, things, people can get away with things. And to be clear, it's not just consensus building. It's often, I think, some of the things that fall apart in wartime are things that seem like they would be effective. And you get the sort of spit and polish, parade ground troops that all look, really shiny with lovely uniforms and all look very impressive.
But their guns all jam when actual people start shooting. Yeah,
exactly. And it turns out this is not a new thing. And in this particular battle, the Romans had brought elephants, and the Greeks, the Macedonians here, had specially trained elephant fighters. But it turned out the elephant fighters didn't work very well.
Now, just to be clear, these are people who fight against elephants. So if you have some elephants, yeah, then the elephant fighters might not be the people you want to see, except these folks had some problems.
That's right. I mean, so it sounded great. And then so Livy actually kind of made a humorous remark here, a very dry remark. He says, "For just as many new devices of mortal men have strength in words, but put to the test when they must function, not just have their function explained, they vanish without any effect. So it was with the elephant fighters. They were a name without a use." And that is, to me, that is the heart of it, which is we can say these things and how they're going to work and how valuable they are, but when put to the test, do they actually function? And I think all the evidence is what we talk about, conversations, mutual learning as a way of generating all the options, that we have, decades of experience about how essential it is for making the best possible trade-offs, require the best possible information, and that wartime leaders have to function that way. They know it. They'll be decisive, they'll be focused, but they're also going to be, make sure that they're as informed as best as possible. And that is proven true throughout history. So that's my final word on that.
Excellent. Well, if listeners are finding themselves in either wartime or peacetime, and they're wondering what they should do, I guess our advice today has been be more decisive. That would probably be useful in peacetime as well, but in wartime you're often forced to do so, whether that's a real shooting war with actual elephants or guns, or more likely for our listeners, a difficult situation, a client who's about to quit, who's about to cancel, or a big deadline looming. Those kinds of pressures are actually very helpful for producing better decision-making and better ideas. Now, some of you may disagree about that, and we like hearing from people who disagree. You guys know that if you've been listening to us for any length of time. So we would sure like to hear from you, and there's lots of ways, including one different way, to get in touch with us. Of course, they all start with agileconversations.com, and that's where you can find our book and our emails and our Twitter and lots of different ways to get in touch with us, as well as free videos and material from our book and our book itself and lots of other good stuff. So we would love to hear from you there, especially if you don't agree with us or if you have questions. So please feel free to get in touch. But there's also a way to meet at least one of us and possibly two in person, and that's in Zagreb, Croatia. Jeffrey, do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So KitCon, which was mostly originally started in 2006 as a continuous integration and testing conference, but now is mostly like, hey, let's talk about good ideas and solutions and problems that we're trying to solve. So KitCon, which is where Squirrel and I first met, we're having KitCon Europe 2024 on May 24th and 25th. And registration's open. We have about 80 spots left. And so we'd love to meet some of our listeners at the event.
Fantastic. And I'm going to try to get there. I'm not going to guarantee it, but I'm certainly going to try. And Jeffrey runs it, so I think he has to show up.
I will be there.
Okay, excellent. So meet at least half of Troubleshooting Agile, and with any luck, we'll be there and even record an episode there, as we often do. So we'd love to hear from listeners in any of those ways, but of course the other way to keep in touch with us is to come back again next week when we'll have another episode of Troubleshooting Agile. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Will.